Hi, I'm Amushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Today we have our friend Cass DeVorsey, who is going to talk to us about big data in politics.
Cass, if you could start with a few things. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what exactly you do.
Sure. My name is Cass DeVorsey. I'm an independent consultant in the world of data and analytics with a focus on political data and analytics for Democratic campaigns and organizations.
And how did you get to being said person?
Good question. I was a physics major as an undergrad. I went to MIT. And after college, I did a variety of things and eventually stumbled into the world of political campaigning. I was lucky enough to join that world at a time when the use of data in both in politics and in the broader world was really taking off. And so several years ago, was when I started, and I've been doing campaigns full-time or mostly full-time since 2008.
So how did you make the jump from being a physics major as an undergraduate to the world of political campaigns?
It's a great question. My mother would like to know the answer as well. I was supposed to have a PhD by this point, and alas, I do not. To be frank, I was a little bit aimless after I graduated from college, and I did a number of different things and eventually wound up volunteering on a political campaign not far from where I grew up in North Carolina. I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, and the campaign was right across the NC border. And just doing the very basic campaign tactics, outreach to voters, a lot of phone calls, door knocking, that sort of thing, helping enter data. And I really got a taste for the adrenaline and the excitement of a political campaign. And of course, it didn't hurt that we won that cycle, which is always a great feeling.
Would you argue that having a science engineering, physics background makes what you do better or different? And you have obviously a different approach. You probably work with a lot of people who, like me, studied political science in college and did all those kind of things when they were younger. And here you are coming from a very technical, very sort of mathematically based background. Do you feel like you're on a different, looking at things differently?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that work in the world of politics who come from a background similar to yours, political science and so forth. But this world of data, the world of big data, which is getting bigger and is employing more people and involving more different types of talent increasingly as years go by, is pulling from a lot of people that have a lot of technical experience similar to my own, people that are PhD statisticians, people that have engineering backgrounds, and so on and so forth. So I'm different than some of the people in politics, but not necessarily in terms of background, different than a lot of the people that I would work most closely with who do the same type of work that I do.
That makes sense. It's a reminder that we talk about data as this sort of cool thing, but it is a science. It really is. It's not just sort of a way to put facts behind things. What's the sort of most surprising changes you've seen in the past couple of years that you've been working on this stuff, whether it's outside understanding of it or whether it's just sort of the expectation that everybody does it? What have you noticed?
Yeah, that's great. And you mentioned two points, I think, that a lot of us who work in this field really have noticed, which is the increasing adoption of data-driven approaches to political work. Several years ago, a lot of the things that we do now, such as predictive modeling, were relatively new and didn't have very widespread adoption in campaign world. Now we've reached a point where pretty much everyone knows the type of work that we do and wants to figure out how to employ it for their organization or their campaign. I don't know if that's necessarily surprising, but it is obviously encouraging for those of us who do this work and have seen the real value that it can add, that it has been that it has become more widespread. And then in terms of what might be surprising on a more technical level, I would say the fact that we're able to continue to innovate on all different levels for work that's done on all different channels is really cool. So there's this idea of helping use data to inform all kinds of different programs, ranging from television ad buys to email campaigns to phone call outreach to direct mail. And we are continuing to figure out the best way to do a lot of these things, particularly for some of the areas that are naturally evolving.
Obviously, with things like Twitter and Snapchat, and all these things popping up so fast and changing so fast and being adopted and then dropped, can the sort of data science keep up with that? Or do you sort of let things go because you have to wait until they settle out or they reach a certain percentage of the population?
I think if there is a sense that a tool or a particular social media platform is taking off, then the data is, I wouldn't even say it's close behind. I would say it's right there as these tools take off.
All right, let's say that I am a brand new candidate. I'm just starting out. I want to run a campaign. I hire you to come in and tell me what to do. What are the first five things that you would tell me I need to do? What would you look at? And what do I have to do that?
Sure. So number one, you would want to figure out what your campaign is going to be most focused on with regards to influencing the electorate. Like I said, there's a couple of things you can do in order to win. Ultimately, you can get people to vote for you by persuading them that your candidate is better than the other candidate. You can get people to vote, period. You think they're going to vote and they just need to be told when and where to go. And then you can register new voters. So what I would do is come in, do an overview of your district, of your state, of the wherever it is that you're running, and figure out what type of voters that we're talking about. And that would allow you to have some basic insight into how you would approach those questions.
So following up on that, let's say 20 years ago, if I were a candidate and I wanted to judge whether or not the electorate was persuadable or whatever, what did you look at in terms of deciding that? Was it sort of demographics, age range, and then what's changed since then?
So we have a lot of the same data available to us now that was available 20 years ago. We know, for instance, how many people are registered in our state or in our district. We know the breakdown by age. We know the breakdown by, say, party affiliation. We know what counties people live in. A lot of the data points that we use to do some of the more advanced work that we do now that we're in 2015 going into 2016 for political work, are the data points are nothing really new. What we are able to do is combine the data points in new ways that people, campaign practitioners, political operatives were not able to do years ago, simply because one, there was not the technical infrastructure for it, and two, there was not the there wasn't really the baseline knowledge.
So using all these things like predictive modeling, taking a step out of sort of the step-by-step things, what are the pitfalls? I mean, I know it's obviously it's all predictive, it's making assumptions. Can you get it really wrong? Is that easier to do than not, or is it pretty hard to get it very wrong?
There are certainly places where you can screw things up in a big way. Any project that involves data has the basic caveat, garbage in, garbage out. So if the underlying data set that you're working with is inaccurate or incomplete, then anything fancy and statistical that you do with it is going to be flawed in sometimes a very bad way. For instance, what we work with a lot in politics are what's called voter files, and these are the lists of every voter registered in a state or a county that are maintained by state or local elections officials. And what's on voter files are basic person information, name, address, age, date of birth, party affiliation, and so forth. The downside to working with these voter files is that they are not necessarily up to date. If I move and I don't update my registration, then whoever is looking at the voter file thinks I'm still living at 123 Elm Street when in fact I moved somewhere else 2 years ago.
Is it possible with all this predictive modeling that you accidentally turn out the wrong part of the electorate?
Absolutely. There's a couple of things that can happen with that. One is that a predictive model is, particularly when you're talking about predicting likely support for a Democratic candidate is a lot like a poll. It's based on an initial survey of the electorate where you ask a bunch of people who they're planning to vote for in the upcoming election, the Democrat or the Republican. And so like a poll, that's accurate essentially at the time it was done. So if you build yourself a model in, let's say, July of an election year, and you continue using it all the way through a November election, if there's major changes in the world, in your campaign, in the state where you're running, in that time period that would affect the results of the election, if you or your opponent says something really crazy that might have an impact on voters' likelihood to vote for you, then the model that you have is a tool that's no longer accurate. It's no longer up to date. It doesn't reflect the reality. So one of the ways things can, one of the ways that things could become inaccurate is just by natural changes in the environment that are not, if you're not updating your score, will not be included.
How common is it to get it that wrong? Does it happen a lot? Does it only happen every
No, it's, honestly, it's, so it's very uncommon to get things wildly wrong. I think public opinion, honestly, doesn't really shift a lot. In a lot of elections, you see polling, you see modeling, everything remains relatively flat for months prior to the election. You don't see, in public polls, sometimes you see wild shifts of opinion that aren't necessarily accurate, that may be due to methodology flaws in the polling, that may be due to other statistical problems, something like that. But getting it wildly wrong is relatively uncommon.
You would have been really screwing up and not paying attention if you get to the end of a campaign and your models are so far off, because you're adjusting on the fly.
That's exactly right. And it's not, even if you aren't adjusting on the fly, you are essentially evaluating on the fly, and you know if things are shifting underfoot.
Can you talk a little bit about how the perception of data has changed? These days, you watch local, cable news, and every other story is about data, and this number says this, and this number says this. But if you're watching, Fox News versus watching MSNBC, they're going to use the same numbers, and they're going to tell you a different story. Has the public come to sort of doubt numbers? Did we used to always trust the poll numbers that were, or whatever numbers were given to us, and now we're sort of like, well, you can make the numbers say whatever you want? I mean, have you noticed a perception change?
I think the public opinion of the so-called big data revolution is something that's continually evolving, which makes sense because it is a field that's continually evolving. Certainly lots of people have concerns about privacy. What is my data being used for, and so forth? But the public is also generally very willing to engage with people who use data. Everyone has a number of supermarket loyalty cards and things like that on their keychain. In other words, you're saying every time you go to CVS or you go to Safeway, I am fine with you as a store tracking everything that I purchase and making me coupon offers and so on and so forth because of that. But that is coupled with some of the negative data stories that you see, which are these high profile data breaches. A company is hacked and thousands of people's private, private social security numbers, private information is leaked to hackers. So opinion, I would say, is very much evolving.
Is it something that, is it going to affect what you do? Is it going to make your job easier or harder? Or are you sort of able to adapt accordingly?
It's a great question. And the short answer is we don't know. For instance, like I mentioned that we work a lot with voter file data. And this is something, voter file data and the privacy of it is not even consistent across US states. Some states, you can go to the state election office's website and download the voter file for the entire state without having to do anything. It's just there available publicly. Some states, the voter file data is restricted to a very limited set of actors, such as political campaigns and political parties, and the state charges for that information. So we don't necessarily know what data will or will not be available to us in future, not least of which because there's relatively little consistency in what data is available now.
A few years ago, I remember reading that Target was using data to predict or pinpoint when a certain customer was pregnant based on, you know, past shopping history, and that they were sent catalogs for baby supplies before they'd even made an announcement to anybody. Is something like this analogous to what could be done in political campaigns, being able to pinpoint and micro-target people?
Well, to some extent, that is what we do now, is we do pinpoint individual people. Certainly, we don't really spend much time thinking about what people purchase at Target. What we do is think about the information that we have on each individual voter to decide whether we're going to send them a piece of mail, or whether we want a canvasser to go knock on their door, or whether they might be asked to donate money to the campaign. And so, similar to the example that you gave, we make these determinations based on pieces of information that we have about each individual. But by and large, if you are someone who works in data for a political campaign, you spend less time thinking about that particular John Doe at 123 Elm Street and more time thinking about the 50,000 people who are going to be in your mail universe, the 50,000 people that you're going to send a piece of mail. And so the decisions that you're making, yes, are using individual data, but we always are rolling it up to aggregates. We're trying to figure out who are the best targets, who are the most efficient people, who are the people that we can gain the most votes from talking to.
Looking at a broader spectrum, what do you hope to be able to do, or capabilities, what sort of is the future looking forward in the data sphere? What do you hope is available to everyone, or hope that changes, or something that you're looking forward to?
For me, what's always most exciting is the particular candidates, because ultimately data does not exist in a vacuum. It exists to serve a particular purpose, to inform decisions that are made. And for me, what's most interesting is when the decisions that are being made on behalf of a candidate that I'm really interested in.
Statistics can only tell you so much, and there's only so many elaborate things that you can do with the numbers that you do get.
Mm-hmm.
At what point can you help further, like, are there any new leaps or bounds in this area?
Or have we reached the capabilities?
Right.
The platforms will change, but it's like statistics is not going to change. We know, by and large, the data science-y piece of it.
So you can do as many calculations or as many different versions of a calculation as you want to show that this section of the electorate is going to be 95% supportive of your candidate. But now the question becomes, how do you communicate with them and how do you convince them to vote?
It gets harder and harder to reach voters, particularly younger voters. A lot of the traditional approaches that we would use, such as phone calls, going to their doors, don't work as well. We reach many fewer people than we would have 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So to that end, campaigns are constantly figuring out, how can we reach people? Is that on Twitter? Is it on Instagram? Is it on Snapchat? And so the data, how the data field will evolve has more to do with those evolving platforms rather than evolving statistical techniques and so forth.
What's the most frustrating thing about dealing with data?
One of the most frustrating things about working with data is that the exciting and cool data stuff and the work that is actually useful to people who want to rely on this information to make decisions has to come way at the end of what's often a very long and arduous process of data hygiene. And that involves dealing with all the different data sources that we make use of, which come in different formats, be it an Excel file, be it someone's old floppy disk, or a PDF that has to be transcribed. It's just basic dealing with...
It's making everything talk to each other?
It's making everything talk to each other. It's making everything, putting everything into a format that is usable and understandable and can communicate with the other data sets that we already have. It's dealing with the scratches of paper that people bring you and say, oh, I have information on this particular person, or I would like some information on this particular person. What can you tell me? And they've handed you a cocktail napkin with some scribbles on it.
So as with most things, it's a whole lot more work than maybe the average person sees on the other end.
If you're in a business or a campaign or any organization, and someone who works with you who's a data person has handed you a shiny report, a spreadsheet, a PowerPoint, something that looks really cool and is graphic and tells you exactly what you need to know.
You should buy them a beer?
You should absolutely buy them a beer or a bottle of champagne, depending on their particular taste. And you should also recognize that the work that went into that is not just the 10 minutes or 10 hours or 10 days that they spent making that particular spreadsheet or PowerPoint, but it is all the work that went into getting the data into a point where they could even do anything with it. And the people who do this work are really the unsung heroes of Data World.
So one last question for me, because I work in the area of drones, as our listeners will have known by now. For the future of campaigns, when we're talking about door-to-door canvassers going and knocking on doors for the electorate, do you imagine it will still be people doing this, or are there going to be little robots that come up to your door and knock on the door and drop off a little flyer that says, go vote today? Can that happen?
I think that's a great question. The data challenges to make that happen are not insignificant. I think, are you going to volunteer to drive the drone from house to house?
The drone can drive itself. That's the whole point of the drone.
But can it? So if for me to part of...
All you need to do is just input your data into the drone's control system, which Mumu will have designed.
So the challenges from that are about what you'd expect. I think if I tell a canvasser to go to 123 Elm Street, that canvasser can stroll up and down and look for a number on a mailbox. And then if he doesn't find one, he can look at the houses and see, oh, look, there's a number. It's kind of hard to see, but that's 123 Elm Street, and he can go knock on that door. Can a drone do that?
Not well yet.
I think technology certainly has a place in campaigns. I think there's lots of tools that we use now that we wouldn't have used, that we didn't have years ago. And so, of course, we didn't use them because we didn't have them.
But I think things like lit drops. Right?
Yeah, I think technology will continue to play an important role in campaigns. And I think new technologies will be adopted for use when it becomes feasible to do so. For instance, we have, whereas 5 years ago, if you were going out to knock on doors, you would have carried a clipboard with a bunch of sheets of paper attached to it, and that would have been the list of voters that you were going to visit, possibly with a map to direct you to their houses. Now that is all on an iPhone. You can walk around with an iPhone in your hand, with a map on your iPhone, with a list of voters on your iPhone. You go to a voter's house, you say, can I count on your support for Senator John Doe, who's running for re-election this fall? The voter says yes. You indicate that on your iPhone. So there's no laborious data entry process to deal with. That being said, I think with regards to the specific example of drones flying around, part of what really has an impact in terms of winning voters' support is the human connection. To have a volunteer who lives possibly in the same neighborhood come to your door and have a conversation with you, I'm supporting Jane Doe for this particular office for X reason, and I would like to ask for your support as well. And if a drone can do that, I will be interested to see it.
So you're saying the human connection is still an intangible that we can't replace with technology?
I don't know. Have you guys seen those new drones that are like these little like robotic like insecty things, but they're the size of dogs, and like people come up and kick them and they don't even like roll over, like they are able to respond to being pushed and they keep standing and keep running?
That's an amazing controls problem.
Yeah.
Wow. It's the I'm fascinated nightmares. By the not be falling over when it's getting kicked.
Did you see the robot cheetah they had at MIT?
Yes. Was that the... Crazy. No, what about the one... Was it MIT where they had the thing with the two
legs? Like,
is that the cheetah one? Yeah. Oh, it's freaky.
Well, that's the new one. They've just got like a new version of that guy.
Oh, it scares me looking at the legs. It's unnatural.
Wait till it gallops up to your door.
I don't want it to gallop to my door.
So do we really want those handing out flyers to you?
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, technology really is becoming more important when it comes to data and campaigns, right?
I think most of what campaigns do uses technology and tools and things of that nature that are very familiar to voters in other contexts. For instance, seeing a TV ad, whether it be for a pickup truck or for a particular candidate, is by and large the same thing. So I think with regards to robots in particular or drones being used in campaigns, I can certainly see that being less of a weird thing when they are more prevalent in society at large. When, for instance, I think I just read something about a hotel, I don't remember where it is now, that's going to have essentially robot room service. So if you call down and you order a cheeseburger to be brought up to room 715, then a robot will bring it.
I would love that. Then there wouldn't be a human judging me for
there would
ordering
not be
fries
a human,
late
yes.
night.
or needing a tip, either way, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, maybe you have to give it some, I don't know, WD-40 or something.
Plug it in for a few minutes right. in the room while you have yeah. it up there. Cass, it's been really great talking to you about all this stuff. I think it's a really interesting field that is often overlooked.
Thanks everyone for listening to episode 3 of Beyond the Microscope with our special guest, Cass DeBorsey.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening!